This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. When Madeleine Albright was the U.S. ambassador to the U.N., spending much of her time at Security Council meetings, she used to kid that if she ever wrote her memoirs, she would call the book 14 Suits and a Skirt. She's followed through on writing the book, but she's given it a different title, Madam Secretary, which reflects the position she held after the UN when President Bill Clinton appointed her Secretary of State. She is the first and only woman to have held the position. Some of the issues and crises she contended with during the Clinton years include the war in the Balkans, the genocide in Rwanda, the terrorist bombings of the U.S. embassies in Africa, the suspension of weapons inspections in Iraq, Middle East peace talks, and the start of the Second Intifada, and the impeachment trial of President Clinton. Her memoir talks about these issues, as well as the ups and downs of her personal life. Albright also has an article in the current edition of Foreign Affairs in which she wrote, "I never thought the day would come when the U.S. would be feared by those it has neither the intention nor the cause to harm. I asked her if she thinks the war in Iraq has negatively affected our stature in the world."
I think there's no question that the war in Iraq has harmed us. I think it has made people wonder about what the purpose of American power is. I think it's important that our adversaries fear us, but I think that when our friends and allies and others are afraid of us, that is not the kind of power that I wanted America to have. I want us to be respected. I think it's a luxury to be loved, but I think respected is what is the appropriate way for countries to feel about us.
You say that although the war was justifiable, it wasn't essential in the short term to protect U.S. security. A policy of containment would have been sufficient. Do you think that there are harmful effects of the war in Iraq that we need to try to contain? And if so, what are they?
Well, I think the most troubling problem is that we have been afraid generally when a particular country becomes a gathering ground for terrorists. That is what happened in Afghanistan. And while I never believed that there was a direct link between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, what I think has happened now is that, in fact, Iraq has become that kind of a gathering ground, a magnet. And President Bush, in his speech last Sunday, basically said that the major fight against terrorism is taking place in Iraq, that that is the center of it, which it well may be, but I have two concerns. One is that it is, in fact, now a gathering ground. And two, that even if we win, which I very much hope we will, that it is not the end of the war on fighting against terrorism, because it has tentacles in a variety of different places. So those are my concerns. And I think that the war in Iraq has, in fact, exacerbated a lot of the problems that we have.
As a former U.N. ambassador, what kind of shape do you think the United Nations is in now after the United States went in to Iraq without Security Council approval?
Well, I think it's taken a certain amount of battering and questioning about its role. On the other hand, there is the positive development, which is a sense that we need the United Nations now, and the meetings that have taken place in Geneva that Secretary General Annan organized in order to try to get a United Nations resolution, I think has elevated the importance of the UN again. Of course, we have to see how that all gets carried out. I've always believed that we are the UN, not just we, but the nation states, and that we are stronger if an organization such as the United Nations exists. And I hope very much that the U.S. will understand the importance of strong support for the United Nations.
Colin Powell is Secretary of State, the position you had under President Clinton. Do you often think what must be going through his mind now? Because after all, the Powell Doctrine said don't get involved militarily in any part of the world where you can't be very confident you're going to have a victory, and probably a quick victory at that. And you should avoid at all costs a quagmire. And quagmire is a word we've been hearing a lot lately, rightly or wrongly, in terms of Iraq. Do you often wonder what's going through Colin Powell's mind now?
Well, I obviously do, but I think that he must have similar feelings to what I think I had. You don't win every one of the internal battles in any administration, and they exist because you have people with different perspectives recognizing different points within an administration, different agencies. But I found that even at times where things hadn't gone exactly my way, you want success. You don't want your country to fail. And so I'm sure he's trying to figure out how to be as supportive as possible of what the Bush administration policy is, which is what he did in his trip to Baghdad. So I think he is looking for points of success.
You write in your memoir, of all the headaches inherited by the Clinton administration, Saddam Hussein was the most persistent. We would spend 8 full years grappling with issues left unresolved at the end of the 92 Persian Gulf War. And you'd been in office less than 3 months when authorities in Kuwait thwarted an assassination attempt against former President George Bush during his visit to Kuwait to commemorate the second anniversary of the Gulf War. Then the FBI told you that the Iraqi intelligence agents were responsible. You were the one who had to call the Iraqis to say that you were about to retaliate with cruise missiles. What is the protocol for calling?
Well,
go ahead.
I have to tell you, that was a genuinely strange meeting. First of all, we did occasionally meet with the Iraqis to do what in diplomatic parlance is called a démarche, in other words, tell them off. And we would often go, a group of us, the permanent members of the Security Council, in order to deliver a message. But that message was usually delivered somewhere in the confines of the United Nations in the Secretariat building. What happened was that I was supposed to deliver this message on a weekend, and the United Nations buildings were closed, and I was sure that the ambassador, Ambassador Hamdoun at that time, was not going to come to the U.S. mission for me to deliver that kind of a message. So I had to go to his place, and he lived in a house on the Upper East Side of New York, and a very nice-looking townhouse. And I got there, and they asked my security people to stay outside. And then I walked in with one of my political officers just to be escorted into a beautiful wood-paneled living room and told to sit down on a sofa right under a huge portrait of Saddam Hussein. And then the ambassador came in, and he thought that I had come. He didn't know why I had come, and so he offered me some tea. And then I said, you know, I am here because your president tried to assassinate my president, and we are currently involved in a bombing raid on your capital in Baghdad. And, of course, then there was no tea. But I also wondered, you know, whether I'd really get out of there, which I obviously did. And then the next day went to the Security Council to offer all the proof that we had, which showed pictures of the various kinds of mechanisms they'd used in this attempt to assassinate former President Bush.
Who do you ask about what the protocol was for a visit like this? How do you find out how to handle it?
Well, I mean, you use your common sense, but you know, I talked to Washington, and we decided whether it was appropriate for me to go there. It's a little hard to deliver a message like that without actually going there. So you kind of work out the protocol as you go, because they're not. This is not a situation that is likely to repeat itself. So you try to use your common sense. I never was invited back, nor would I have gone.
Did you ask yourself what would have happened, what the repercussions would have been had that assassination attempt on President Bush, on former President Bush, succeeded?
Well, I think that it would have been horrendous, and I think that we would have clearly had to have declared, you know, military action at that time. You can't have a president assassinated and have that kind of thing go unrecognized. We actually spent most of our time trying to figure out how to determine who did the who actually tried the assassination attempt and put all the facts together. And I was not in meetings where we speculated about what to do had it succeeded, but I'm sure that we would have retaliated very strongly.
My guest is Madeleine Albright. She has a new memoir called Madam Secretary. She was Secretary of State in the Clinton administration when the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania were bombed in August 1998, killing 224 people and injuring more than 5,400. Osama bin Laden was suspected of masterminding and financing the bombings and was placed on the FBI's 10 Most Wanted list. After the al-Qaeda attacks on the two embassies, the Clinton administration launched 650 bomber or missile sorties lasting about 70 hours. What do you think that accomplished?
Well, I think that what was very important was, I have to say, my worst day as Secretary of State was when our embassies were bombed in August 1998. I think that was horrendous. It was, so to speak, my people, people that worked for the State Department, diplomats and Foreign Service nationals that were there, and it was horrendous. And it was something that we had to take action against. We showed that we would not countenance this kind of activity. We launched 75 cruise missiles against a camp of Osama bin Laden's, and we came very close to getting him. We also launched a bombing against a pharmaceutical factory in Sudan that was associated with Osama bin Laden, had been owned by him and his operatives, that we had proof had been involved in chemical weapons production. So we took what action we had, and had we had more intelligence at that time that would have pinpointed where Osama bin Laden was, we would have taken further military action. And if you remember, one of our problems was that most people thought we'd made it up. I mean, the whole pre-9/11 mood in the United States didn't understand that one had to retaliate when there was action by terrorists against Americans.
Do you have any regrets on how the Clinton administration handled al-Qaeda?
No, I don't, because I can tell you from everything that I was involved in, this was daily fare for us. Every day talked in some form about what could be done. President Clinton put out some executive orders that would have allowed for lethal force to be used against Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and developed the whole structure of fighting terrorism, getting the U.S. prepared for it. You know, the way that now people are tracking the money of the terrorists, that was something that President Clinton put into place. We increased the budgets of the CIA and the FBI. And what we did was, as I say, to consume every bit of intelligence that we had. Also, there were what I call the dogs that didn't bark. We were able to foil a whole host of different events that never made the news because we, in fact, made sure they didn't happen. So I think we did everything we could. We also talked a lot about the need to keep track of it every day. And when we briefed the new administration about it, I think they were a little surprised about how much work it would take to follow and track terrorists and to deal with the issue on a daily basis.
If you're just joining us, my guest is former Secretary of State Madeleine Albright. She's written a new memoir, which is called Madam Secretary. You write in your memoir, "I am often asked whether I was condescended to by men as I traveled around the world to Arab countries and other places with highly traditional cultures. I replied no, because when I arrived somewhere, it was in a large plane with the U.S. of A. emblazoned on the side. Foreign officials respect that. I had more problems with some of the men in my own government." What are some of the problems you had with some of the men in your own government?
Well, I think that, especially when I started at the United Nations, and I was a member of what is called the so-called Principles Committee, which is a small group that includes the National Security Advisor, the Secretary of State, the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, and the Director of the CIA, and the Ambassador to the UN, and in our case, because every administration can change the grouping of the principals. So I was a part of this group, and I had very strong opinions, especially about Bosnia, and I really was condescended to by the National Security Advisor, who has been a very good friend of mine, and kind of made me feel as if my opinions were overly strong, or, to use a word that's often used against women, emotional, mainly because I felt very strongly about it. Also, the thing that I found, and this is the hardest part, is that even men that are very good friends and very nice people and have wives and daughters don't often understand that something that they say or the dismissiveness of their tone makes you feel that your views are not welcome. And I think for the most part, many of them don't know they're doing it. It just gets pretty irritating.
Tell me if you feel like you ever had to deal with this in your career as somebody who is very high-powered and having to fly around the world talking with heads of state. A lot of women, particularly women who are like in their 40s and over, feel like they were brought up to be socialized, to be liked, to please, and, you know, to accommodate. And sure, there's a certain amount of pleasing and accommodation that's a part of diplomacy, but there's also the necessity of, you know, of being tough, of saying no, of holding your ground no matter what. Do you feel like in your career you ever had to overcome that impulse to accommodate, to be nice, to be liked?
Oh, my goodness, yes. I can't tell you how many times. First of all, I do think that most women want to be liked, and they don't want to have face-to-face personal arguments. It was even larger in my case, because as I write in the first part of my book, having come to the United States as a foreigner and having constantly been moving around, I really wanted to be part of a group, and I did want to be liked. I still want to be liked. So I think that it's something that's very much a part of me and a part of women. Now, the other thing that I learned, and I learned it very quickly when I got to the United Nations, is that you can't do the kind of normal women thing, which is to wait a while to get a sense of what a meeting is like, you know, kind of get the tenor of the room, who says what. And I was went to my first meeting of the Security Council and kind of thought I'd take my time, and all of a sudden it dawned on me I couldn't take my time. I was the United States. If I didn't speak, then the United States would not, our views would not be heard. And so I got over that very quickly. The part that I think is very hard, and I think I probably speak for other women in this, is men are capable of having strong policy disagreements or arguments about a subject and then walk out of a room and go and play golf or have a drink or something. And I think women do take it more personally. And I don't think we like to have face-to-face confrontations. But I sure learned that it was essential to state my views very clearly and not care whether I was liked or not. And it took me a while to learn it. But I think others will testify to the fact that I did learn it.
What is it like to fly to a country like Saudi Arabia to practice diplomacy, knowing that in that country women have to be shrouded, women can't drive, and granted, they understand you're a woman from a different culture, but you're still a woman?
Well, first of all, you really do think about the fact that you're going into this kind of a country where sisters have a very different lifestyle, and I find it appalling. Nevertheless, I had to carry on my duties as Secretary of State. And when I arrived, I decided that I wore a hat when I got off the plane. But I think you might have noticed I wore a hat pretty much every time I got off a plane because my hair looked so awful after a night on the plane. And then I did not wear any covering on my head when I spoke to the ministers or the king or the crown prince. So I did not take any particular action of that kind. And in my first meeting with what's known as the Gulf Cooperation Council, those are the ministers from all the Gulf states, we had a very serious conversation. And at the end of it, I said to them, you may notice that I am not clothed exactly the way my predecessors were, and I thank you very much for your great courtesy and kindness, and next time we'll talk about women's rights. And they were a little surprised. On the other hand, one of the foreign ministers said, you know, I think we, in fact, might have a foreign minister as a woman in the period of the length of our history, because they're relatively new countries, that's shorter than it took the United States to have a woman Secretary of State. That same foreign minister then invited me to his home and introduced me to his daughters, who had American educations, and I think we're probably going to end up having quite a different life from some of the other people. But it's there's no question that it's a touchy issue, and that it creates a certain level of difficulty, but not when you are representing the United States. I must say that I had the greatest respect from those leaders, especially, well, all of them, but I had a very good relationship with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia, Crown Prince Abdullah.
Your first position in the Clinton administration was as UN ambassador. Your father was a diplomat. Your father had served as UN ambassador from Czechoslovakia. Would you just give us a brief chronology of your father's diplomatic positions?
Yes. Well, my father had wanted to be and was a young diplomat in the new free Czechoslovakia in the interwar period. And he first was press attaché in Yugoslavia, and then when the Nazis invaded Czechoslovakia, he went and moved to London with all of us to when the government was in exile in London, returned after the war, and was made ambassador to Yugoslavia. He then had an assignment representing Czechoslovakia on a new commission, which had to do with the problem of Kashmir between India and Pakistan, a problem we live with today. And it was through that particular commission created by the United Nations that we came to the United States.
You say that it wasn't until you became UN ambassador that you understood how precarious your family status here had been. Your father had applied for political asylum for himself and for the family after the communist takeover of Czechoslovakia. And it wasn't until you became UN ambassador that you realized how difficult it was for him to get that. What were the problems?
Well, the real problem was that this commission and his assignment to it had been created before the communist coup in 1948 in Czechoslovakia. He was persuaded to keep the assignment by the British and American ambassadors. And in fact, he had an agreement with the British government that he would never report to his own government because as Philip Noel Baker, who had been the Foreign Secretary of the United Kingdom at that time, said to him, if your country's just had a coup, they don't have any idea about what is happening on some commission to do with India and Pakistan, but if you resign, they will name a communist, and it would be important to have an objective person on that commission. So why don't you just report to us, which he did. And then he came to the United States on a diplomatic passport, and the question was whether he should continue even nominally representing what was then a communist government. So he wanted to resign as quickly as possible. And the question was whether he could resign and get political asylum quickly or ultimately become a stateless person. And so he did, in fact, in the end, he was fired and he got political asylum. So these papers that I was given showed how all these discussions went back and forth and how he wanted to quit, and he was basically being told, hang in there, wait a while, because you have no status whatsoever. So that was the precarious aspect, and then he got political asylum, and the next precarious aspect was to try to figure out how to get a job in the United States, and it was thanks to the Rockefeller Foundation that they found a job for him at the University of Denver in what was basically their international relations department, and he stayed there for the rest of his life.
How do you think that, you know, being from Czechoslovakia influenced your feelings about Bosnia and Kosovo and your stand that there should be military intervention?
Well, first of all, everybody has their baggage, and mine clearly was Munich, an agreement made in September 1938 by the so-called Western powers, excluding the United States, to give away a piece of Czechoslovakia to Hitler, in other words, to appease aggression. And that was kind of a signal moment in the history of Czechoslovakia, and something that my parents talked about a lot, that if you don't stand up to an aggressor, that, in fact, the aggressor will only take more. The other parts that affected my life was that I clearly understood the horrors of not standing up to Hitler in other ways with the Holocaust, and understanding that you could not permit ethnic cleansing to go unanswered. During the Second World War, a lot of people legitimately could say that they had no idea what was being done in terms of ethnic cleansing. We did know what was going on in Bosnia because of, obviously, a whole revolution in information. I also knew a lot about Yugoslavia from the fact that my father had been ambassador there, and while I had only been of the ages from 8 to 11, I grew up learning about the problems of Yugoslavia. So those are all the reasons why I thought it was important to stand up to Milosevic.
Now, you married Joe Albright, who was from a very wealthy family, the family that owned the newspaper Newsday. Did you suddenly find yourself in a much more privileged world than the world you had traveled in? I know your father, who had been a diplomat, probably knew a lot of very important and powerful people. But still, was this a different world for you?
Well, it was a completely different world. But the truth is that when my father had been ambassador, you know, we lived in an embassy and had a chauffeur and a maid and a cook and a butler and various other accoutrements of a privileged life. But then when we came to the United States, we were, as was known at the time, displaced persons, and arrived in Denver with nothing beyond this green Ford coupe that my parents had bought. And so people lent us furniture, and we bought some junky furniture and lived in university rental housing. So life was quite different physically, never different intellectually or emotionally, because my parents were very clear that our life would go on in a respected way. But when I did marry into Joe's family, it was quite different. It is it's a family that had many houses and servants and a lot of privileges.
You write in your book that your husband divorced you in 1983. He told you that he'd fallen in love with a woman who was a reporter, who was considerably younger and beautiful. And you say that you hope that he was just being noble and brave because he was really diagnosed with a brain tumor and was just trying to spare his family the pain of watching him suffer. Well, unfortunately, fortunately, whatever, that wasn't the case. And he was just leaving you for another woman. You say that when he did leave you, it left you with no confidence in your looks. Did you get over that? And as a woman who spent her life in the limelight, in front of cameras, but not in a beauty pageant, in diplomatic positions, in Secretary of State, you know, in the position of Secretary of State, did looks matter to you? How important was that?
Well, I all I have to do is look in the mirror to know I'm no raving beauty, but it does help if you feel good about yourself. And so I think that if you go around moping or, you decide one day you're never going to wear makeup, it doesn't work. I do think that you have to remember that you are representing your country. And it's very interesting. I actually don't think I wrote this in the book, but before I went up to the UN, I met with Jean Kirkpatrick, one of my predecessors, and obviously also a woman and a professor. And when Jean Kirkpatrick... we probably disagree a lot on policy, but our lives are not dissimilar because we both taught at Georgetown. And what she did was ask me to come in and talk to her, or we had lunch. And she said, she was very funny, she said, "Madeline, get rid of the professor clothes and buy yourself some good clothes because you really do need to look good for this job." So Jean and I agree on those particular issues, and it does matter how you look.
It matters why.
Because I think not so much, I mean, if you're beautiful or not, but if you look confident and you look put together, I think it does play a role in how you present your case. And I tell one story in the book where we had had all-night negotiations on a resolution to do with Haiti. And I had done real retail diplomacy, gone around and talked to every one of the Security Council members. And I looked exhausted and... I rumpled my hair and all the makeup was off of my face, but we were going to have time between what I was doing and the final vote. So I went back to my apartment, started all over, put on a blue linen dress that I thought I looked good in, came back, looked a lot better than all my colleagues who were unshaven, and I think it looked as though I had confidence. We won the vote. I don't think because of my blue dress, but I think it does help to look good.
Shortly after becoming Secretary of State, the Washington Post reporter Michael Dobbs came to you with information that your family was actually Jewish, not Catholic, and that three of your grandparents were victims of the Holocaust, as well as at least one of your cousins. You write about this a little bit in your book, and about how people couldn't believe you didn't know, and that it made it, they made it seem like you had covered it up. You say, I was made to feel as if I were a liar, and that my father was portrayed as a heartless fraud. You never knew about it till Michael Dobbs told you?
Well, I didn't. I mean, what happened was that I think I explain in the first part of the book that my parents talked a great deal about their lives in pre-World War II Czechoslovakia and about generally history, and that when we returned after the war, I was 8 years old, and that my grandparents were not alive, and I was told that they died of old age. And I had no, this is a very tragic part of everything, I have to say. I mean, I didn't know any grandparents, so they never were real people for me, so I didn't kind of absorb that at all. But I grew up as a practicing Catholic, actually a pretty good one, and there were no holes in the story of my life. But what happened when I started being in the news, I would get letters from people saying that they knew something about my family, and they would write facts that didn't make sense. I mean, they would have the wrong name of my mother, or have them coming from the wrong town, or somebody would say they'd gone to high school with my father in a time when he would have been a child. And first of all, I got a ton of mail just generally, just so you know. But among those letters, occasionally it would say something like, you know, you're a Jew bitch, so which I kind of, and which is why you feel the way you do about the Serbs. I chose to discount letters like that. But there were hints of things, but it didn't all come together until in December 1996, as I was being named to be Secretary of State, I got a letter that seemed to have all the facts together. And so when I was being vetted by the White House lawyers, I told them that I had reason to suspect that my family was of Jewish background, and they basically found that very uninteresting. I discussed with my children about all of this, and being of Jewish background, I thought, really added to the already very rich tapestry of my life. I thought it was fascinating, and I really wanted to look into it more. And then Michael Dobbs came up. Michael Dobbs actually called me during the transition period and said he was going to do a profile of me, and I gave him a bunch of addresses of people in Yugoslavia and in Czechoslovakia. And then he's the one who came up with the fact that three of my grandparents had died in concentration camps, which is quite different from finding out that you're of Jewish background. And it was the horror of finding out about the horrible death of my grandparents that truly was the great tragedy. And in addition to the divorce chapter, this was the hardest chapter to write. And I tried to really lay it out and try to explain why it was so difficult and how hurtful it was to have my father, whom I adored, be accused of trying to hide the facts when, from everything that I knew about my parents, all they ever did was try to figure out ways to protect us.
What do you think their motivation was? Not only in, I mean, I guess the motivation for changing their religion is fairly obvious, to survive during the Nazi era, but what do you think their motivation was to never tell you?
Well, again, it's hard to try to figure out motivation, but I think the following thing, again, that you have to put yourself back into the period. They had gone through having to leave their country twice. They came to the United States in 1948-49, and then in the 50s when we were getting our citizenship, which took longer, frankly, because of that complicated story I told you before about the fact that for a period of time my father actually nominally represented a communist government while he never reported to them, so that was confusing. and it was the period of McCarthyism, and I think they just thought that it was safer not to tell. By the way, I have the highest respect for Harry Truman and think he's one of the great American presidents, but if you read what has recently been revealed about what he said about Jews, then I think one can understand why my parents coming to a new country from a country where Jews have been exterminated might have thought that it was wiser not to tell us. Why they didn't tell me later, it's hard for me to speculate about, except that I left home right after high school, basically got married 3 days after college, and there must have just not been a good time, but I don't know the answer.
Did it change your stature in terms of negotiations when it was disclosed that you were of Jewish descent? What I'm thinking is you write that some Arab paper said that since you were Jewish, this would make Tel Aviv rather than Washington the capital of American foreign policy. Were there places where you felt that things actually got more difficult with the people you were negotiating with?
I never had that experience. I think that there were those people who thought I would, but to the best of my knowledge, I did not have that kind of experience. Nobody ever said, you don't understand this because, you know, your family was Jewish. I never had that. I found those kinds of initial statements obviously outrageous and insulting. It hadn't hurt Henry Kissinger. So I think that I was quite appalled at that.
If you don't mind my asking, I'm wondering if you practice any religion now. You know, you grew up Roman Catholic. At your husband's request, when you got married, you joined the Episcopal Church and then found out later in life that your family is really of Jewish descent. So where are you now in terms
well,
of faith?
I have written, actually, that it's confusing. I mean, it's a little hard to be 66 years old and be unclear about something like this. I was raised a Christian, and I don't see myself not being a Christian. I find it very difficult to assimilate all of it, and I don't know. I mean, I go to an Episcopalian church when I go, but many of my beliefs are very Catholic because I grew up a Catholic, and I respect Judaism, but I don't see myself practicing it. So, I have to honestly admit that it's sad in many ways to be this old and to be unclear about something that is so basic.
Let's talk for a moment about the Middle East. The Clinton administration worked so hard for peace in the Middle East, and things are just falling apart now. Is there anything in retrospect you wish you had done that you didn't do?
No, actually. I mean, we worked so hard on this. I think the most amazing part is how completely dedicated President Clinton was to this issue, how he knew every detail of what was going on, how much time he spent on it, and how much time he wanted all of us to spend on it. We tried many, many different kinds of venues. I traveled to the Middle East very frequently, and I met with whoever the Israeli Prime Minister was and Chairman Arafat scores and scores of times. We were deeply involved in it. We also had a very highly trained and educated Middle East peace team headed by Ambassador Dennis Ross, who had come to us from the previous Bush administration because we really did believe in continuity of foreign policy. And Dennis was the kind of a person who, if Arafat, for instance, would say, well, I didn't agree to that, he would say, yes, you did. It was August 4th. We were sitting in your office. We were drinking tea, and it was hot. I mean, so that he would call somebody on everything. That team was dismantled, which I consider a great tragedy. And the things that we had been working on at the end were not followed through. I think that obviously there are tactical things that we might have done differently, especially before we went to Camp David. It might have been useful to try to work more closely with some of the moderate Arab regimes in order to get them to push Arafat. But as I explain in the book, that was a little difficult because we didn't have all the bottom lines that Prime Minister Barak was putting forward. So You know, in retrospect, that is the kind of thing. But I think we tried everything we possibly could, and we're very dedicated to the issue from President Clinton on down.
You do write that you think you should have pushed Israel harder to halt the expansion of settlements.
Well, we all the time talked about the fact that settlements, I said on a regular basis that they created problems for the negotiation. They were obstacles. We used different words about them. And felt that they were a problem. I think the thing we should have done, I guess just generally, is try to hold both sides much more accountable to the specific things they were supposed to do. We thought we were doing it, but I think, you know, just as in now, in the roadmap, there is not holding both sides accountable to the tasks that they have to perform. But we tried very hard. Obviously, there are things we could have done differently, but not for lack of trying.
Just one question about the Monica Lewinsky affair. Was it difficult for you to, you know, to keep on message and to go about your business during the whole Monica Lewinsky era and the impeachment crisis? Was it hard to stay focused?
Well, first of all, I have said this, and I said it at the time, that basically, in terms of foreign policy, it didn't affect us, me. I was able to do my job. President Clinton was completely focused on the issues that I dealt with. For instance, as you read the book, you can see that we were at Y River doing the talks with the Israelis and the Palestinians on October 98, which was very much a period where Monica issues were going on. And yet the president was completely focused on what we were doing. I had every opportunity to see him whenever I wanted. So it did not affect me. I think the hard part was that if I was on a show at that time or with a reporter, that would be something that the reporter would want to have answers to, and it would detract from the 5 minutes that I had on whatever TV show there was.
Were you angry at the president for misleading you?
Sure, I was, and very disappointed, and I think that what he did was stupid. But I do think that in issues of policy, foreign policy, and the respect that the world had for the United States during President Clinton's time, I think, is something that needs to be remembered. I was very proud to serve President Clinton. I think he's one of the great presidents, and that is, for me, what is most important. I'm not the one that was betrayed, and I was angry, and I think what he did was dumb, but I think he's a great president.
Finally, since you spent so much of your career traveling around the world, any tips for jet lag? I don't know how you do it, how you can carry on such high-level negotiations in a constant state of jet lag. But
well, you know, actually, there's something about it. First of all, there is an advantage to not being in, you know, to being my age. You need to sleep less. And then I have to admit that I would sleep on command. I'd get on the plane, let's say at 4 o'clock in Washington, and know that I had to speak and be at a meeting, which would theoretically be in the middle of the night in, you know, Germany or something, and I'd take sleeping pills. I could sleep on command. But sometimes you move around so fast that jet lag can't catch up with you.
Madeleine Albright served as U.N. Ambassador and Secretary of State in the Clinton administration. Her new autobiography is called Madam Secretary.